Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. On September 25, 2004, the plaintiff, Nathaniel Manor, was driving a Yamaha motorcycle down the road when he was struck by a drunk driver named Nicholas Schiermeier. He suffered extensive injuries in that accident with a stipulated damages amount of $1.5 million. At issue are four policies of insurance, two of which were issued to Nathaniel by American Family, one of which was issued to Nathaniel by American Standard. The fourth policy also was issued by American Standard, but to Nathaniel's father, James Manor. Nathaniel seeks UMI, underinsured motorist coverage, under all four of these policies in the full limits. The defendants contend that Nathaniel is entitled to nothing. Your Honors, there are a lot, or really a very few, issues in this case, depending on whether Nathaniel did or did not own the motorcycle he was operating at the time of the accident. But all of these issues can be resolved by one overriding legal question, and that is there an ambiguity in one or more provision? Because if there is, the ambiguity as a matter of law is resolved against the insurer and in favor of the insured.
Now, what do we use for ownership? Is it normally in Missouri, it's a title.
That is correct.
But in this situation, do we have a different definition for ownership?
Your Honor, my answer to that question is on the second chart. There are two answers.
That is ambiguity if you have two answers.
I'm sorry, can I get you to do me a favor? That light is kind of tilted, so it's in our eyes. If you could turn it down just a speck. Even better.
Sure.
Thank you very much.
The first question is interpretation of the policy. And I think as this court recognized in Leitner and the Safeco case, the word own, if it's not defined in the policy, is ambiguous. And because it's ambiguous, because it can mean more than one thing, then it must take the meaning most favorable to the insured. In this case, the most favorable meaning to coverage is the usual meaning of owned when we're dealing with motor vehicles, and that's title. It's not disputed in this case that Nathaniel did not have title to the Yamaha, and so Nathaniel...
His uncle still had title, is that...
That's correct, Your Honor, and that's not a disputed fact. So there is no fact issue, and Nathaniel was entitled to summary judgment on that issue. Now, I will also say that even if you say that title is not dispositive, the fact that Nathaniel did not have title is still prima facie evidence that he didn't own the motorcycle. So the question then becomes whether or not the defendants sufficiently rebutted that prima facie evidence to support their own summary judgment or to defeat Nathaniel's summary judgment motion. And respectfully, the answer to that question is no. Just very briefly,
say it's prima facie, if he doesn't have title, it's prima facie that he doesn't own it, then does that fall then on the plaintiff to prove he does have ownership?
We put in prima facie evidence that he did not own the motorcycle.
It benefits plaintiffs show that plaintiff does not have ownership because then the exclusions do not, certain exclusions do not apply.
Right.
And can you, because there's so many arguments and so many exclusions and so many policies, I see you're trying to do that here, but if you could kind of explain it more clearly, assuming just for the sake of this part of the argument, we agreed with you that either title doesn't equal ownership or that the prima facie case was not rebutted, what does that mean in terms of how does that affect each of the four policies?
Your Honor, if you just go down this list,
I was kind of looking, but I could still use some help.
Yeah, it's pretty simple. The issues are less. The analysis is different if he did own. If he didn't, the issues are less and they're simpler. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think they're all already resolved. Number one, Nathaniel can stack all of the policies at issue under the second sentence, the excess language, in the second sentence of the other insurance provision.
And you cite the Nisswanger case, which I thought was a very good cite.
opposing counsel, I'm sure, will say there's still defenses that apply even if he's held not to be the owner?
I don't believe so, not on the stacking issue, Your Honor, no.
Okay.
I think it's pretty clear in the law you get to stack these policies under all these cases that I've listed. Number two is this general provision. Number three, it's the two or more cars provision. That is not in the endorsement. That's in the main body of the policy. But to the extent that purports to say that the insurance company's liability is no higher than any one policy, then it expressly conflicts with the second sentence of the other insurance clause, which says that similar insurance, which clearly includes at least UMI insurance, is excess. So you clearly do get to stack. So there's a conflict, and the second sentence prevails as held in Chalmers.
As I think you also had an argument that the two or more vehicles would only apply to the cars because the motorcycles were owned by different policies, or am I making
Yes, that? No, that's correct. Mm-hmm. And that's whether he owned the motorcycle or not.
Okay.
Because the two or more cars language, there's only one motorcycle and one company for Nathaniel, and the same is true of James.
And can you explain to me in a little bit more detail, if we found the no two or more vehicles did apply to the endorsement, even though it was in the main body of it, why is that in conflict with other provisions? Why do you think it's not applicable?
If Nathaniel did not own the motorcycle, mm-hmm. then the second sentence, the excess language of the
Since I don't have it memorized, what's the second mm-hmm. sentence?
The second sentence of the other insurance clause, which is it is identical to Ritchie and not Ritchie, I'm sorry. Well, yeah, Ritchie, Seek, Nisswanger, they're all the same language. The second sentence says, any insurance provided under this endorsement for an insured person while occupying a vehicle you do not own is excess over any similar insurance. So any similar insurance at least includes other UMI policies. Mm-hmm. So you've got four policies. You stack all those policies because they're excess one over another.
I understand your argument is you can't say you get coverage here and then somewhere several pages later say we didn't really need it.
Well, that is correct. We do make that argument.
But you're saying if you own two or more vehicles, there's only one coverage is inconsistent with saying if there's two that apply, we're excess because that recognizes two may apply? Or
Your Honor, if Nathaniel does not own the vehicle,
right.
then Chalmers and Ragsdale are the cases to look at because you've got a policy a provision that expressly says one of these is excess over the other. Mm-hmm. You stack them, and then somewhere else you have another provision that says or purports to say, well, no, you can't. Mm-hmm. And we've got another argument that provision is ambiguous in any event because it's not in the endorsement and because it clearly at least seems to imply that it's dealing with vehicles insured, where UIM coverage doesn't have anything to do with vehicles insured or whether you own the car or whether you are occupying the insured vehicle. It's personal coverage. So for that reason also, we think that provision doesn't apply. Your Honors, I'd like to just kind of get back real quick to, did Nathaniel own the Yamaha? And back to the prima facie evidence. And I'd like to just point out a couple of things. I mean, even if you say, like I said, title is not dispositive, the evidence that the defendants offer is really slim to none. And again, we fulfilled our burden with prima facie evidence that he did not have title. For example, the defendants say at several points in their brief that Nathaniel had, quote, purchased the Yamaha from his uncle, when in truth, what the evidence says is that Nathaniel had paid some money to his uncle for the Yamaha. So, in fact, he was purchasing the Yamaha, he hadn't already purchased it.
Is it your position, though, even if, let's say, for example, he had paid the entire amount due to his uncle, but title had not been issued by Department of Motor Vehicles, would that then constitute he did not own the vehicle?
Your Honor, I think that is exactly right. If you stay true to the tenets of construction, we acknowledge this word that's undefined to be ambiguous, you must take the meaning most favorable to the insured. The usual meaning for motor vehicles is title. If you're construing
own... You're saying, if I understand from that, you're saying it could mean either. It's unclear. Which it would mean, and so you have to construe it in favor of the insured.
That's correct.
But is this a case where the title had been assigned but not issued yet, or in this case, as I understand it,
no, Your Honor.
Assigned, right?
No, Your Honor. There is absolutely no evidence. In fact, there's affirmative evidence that Nathaniel said, I don't remember that any steps had been taken, which is consistent with the idea that he hadn't finished purchasing it. This is not a case where you've got somebody who signs off the certificate and then you've got a defective notary or something else.
In this case, there's no assignment on any title.
No, there isn't. The other thing that the defendants seem to make a pretty big deal about is that he obtained this policy of insurance. And respectfully, Your Honors, that may mean that Nathaniel's a responsible driver, but it doesn't have one thing to do with ownership. These policies do not require that a policyholder own the vehicle in order to have either liability insurance or UIM insurance. For the liability portion, you just have to be using the vehicle.
And in fact, you can violate Missouri law if you're driving a vehicle without insurance, whether or not you own a vehicle.
That's correct. It's either an owner's policy or a user's policy, mm-hmm. an operator's policy. So the fact that he took out insurance just doesn't mean a thing. There's another bit of testimony that the defendants rely on heavily, and that is that Nathaniel, quote, treated the motorcycle as his own. I think the question was asked, did you treat it like your own? Sure. And, Your Honors, number one, I just have to point out that's not in the defendant's statement of facts, so we really shouldn't consider it at all on summary judgment. But that doesn't mean anything. I mean, frankly, I treat rental cars as my own. I treat them better than my own because the rental company cares about it more than I do. So that statement really has very little meaning. I'll also note, and this is not in the brief, but it is in the record, and I think it's significant, that at the time that the events here occurred, what Nathaniel told the officer who was making out the report is, here's who owns the vehicle. It's James A. Payne. That's the uncle. So that's Defendant's Exhibit E. The last thing we have is possession. And if Leitner means anything, it's that possession is not enough. The mere fact that, am I out of time? Yes,
yeah,
I'm so sorry.
You finish your thought.
The mere fact that you have possession of something does not mean that you own it, especially when we're dealing with a motor vehicle. That's true certainly under Leitner and even under the dictionary definition that the defendants provide in their brief.
You still have time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court. Good morning.
Good morning.
I will set forth, because I know the court already addressed this in the appellant's aspect, I will set forth as best that I can our position with regard to this. And I understand ownership is a key issue apparently with the court here. So bear with me for just a few moments. I'll set forth the same position on behalf of American Family and American Standard to this court that we set forth in the Eastern District and also at the trial court. If this court determines that the Yamaha was a non-owned vehicle, that Nathaniel did not own the motorcycle, we agree that the Yamaha and the Ford policies apply. Chamness, Niswanger, Seek, Ragsdale, and Ritchie have all made that crystal clear to us. That's the same position that we've taken since the trial court. If this court determines that the Yamaha was owned by Nathaniel, then we do not owe under the Yamaha and the Ford policies because of the owned vehicle exclusion. Assuming that this court finds that it is an owned vehicle, then with regard to the issue on James, the father's Suzuki policy, the residency issue is irrelevant. And I know that was an issue that was brought up in the Court of Appeals opinion. And the reason for that is because it doesn't matter, because there's no way to stack the James Suzuki policy and the Nathaniel Yamaha policy, because you're outside the second sentence of the other insurance clause.
Because It's owned?
Because it's an owned vehicle as opposed to a non-owned vehicle. It's the second sentence of the other insurance clause that Chamness, Niswonger, Seek, Ragsdale, and Ritchie make it an excess situation. So what this case boils down to is whether or not it's an owned vehicle. All the other stuff is issues that we've briefed and that have been asked by the courts, but at the end of the day, what we got is whether or not it's an owned vehicle. And one more thing that I'd like the court to keep in mind. Unless I'm wrong, there's no other case, and I'm assuming that this is that the Yamaha is determined to be an owned vehicle, and this will address all the other issues. Unless I'm wrong, there's no other cases out there, UIM cases, dealing with this language, where the tortfeasor has had liability limits that are equal to or in excess of the UIM coverage on an owned vehicle situation where there's been UIM coverage that's stuck. So again, we're down to whether or not this is an owned vehicle situation. So I think the Missouri Court of Appeals hit it right on the head in their opinion that they have to decide whether or not the owned vehicle exclusion applies. And I believe it does for the following reasons. The purpose of an owned vehicle exclusion is designed to exclude bodily injury coverage when you're occupying an owned vehicle, but it's not insured under the policy. So think about that. The purpose is to exclude bodily injury UIM coverage when you're occupying an owned vehicle and it's not insured under the policy.
But you don't require people to own the vehicle to get that policy.
No, that's what we have in this particular case, Judge. Think about it. What you could have, in theory, if you don't apply this particular owned vehicle exclusion, you could have family of four, mom, dad, and two teenage drivers. If you don't have an owned vehicle exclusion under one of their four cars, they could buy UIM coverage, and dad would be covered as the policyholder, mom would be covered as the policyholder, and the two kids would all be covered as relatives under that one UIM coverage. And then in the morning, when mom and dad take off for work and the kids take off for school, all four of them are covered with UIM coverage under one policy. That's not right. That doesn't allocate the risk under the UIM policy, which required...
But isn't it incumbent on the insurer to use language that says if a family owns a funeral, you have to have a separate UIM on each... You make it dependent on owner, so it all comes back to what is owning, and you're trying to say owning has to be broadly construed to mean what? Anybody who's paid any money down on a vehicle? The uncle had an accident? Would he have been claimed to be an owner since he still had the title? So there's two owners?
Well, what we learned from, Judge, to answer your question, what we learned from Leitner, Safeco, and the Paul cases, they tell us that with regard to an insurable interest, all that's necessary is possession and the right to control over the vehicle. But title isn't determinative.
But you didn't say if you have an insurable interest. You said if you're owner. And so
does this policy define owner?
This policy does not define owner.
Okay. So if the policy doesn't define owner, then do we look at to determine what own means for purposes of your policy, which you had the ability to define if you wanted to but didn't?
Correct.
Okay. So then why does own necessarily equate to insured interest?
Because
you could have defined own to be insured interest if you wanted to. You drafted this contract, you didn't.
American Family, American Standard did not define own. That's correct, Judge. But what we have here, keeping in mind what I just said about the owned vehicle exclusion, is intended such that each car in the family needs to purchase UIM coverage. And again, when you have the possession or control, as we're taught under Leitner, Safeco, and Paul policies, it's that touchstone, the possession, the ability to control, the ability to let somebody else use it, the ability to drive it. That's what's determinative as far as ownership under those other three cases,
I'm
and
unclear.
I think should be controlling in this case here.
I thought you were saying insurable interest was the definition, but now you're saying ownership and control?
That's what Leitner, Safeco, and Paul tell us. It's ownership, it's possession, it's the ability to control, That's what's determinative here. Remember, Nathaniel...
Well, were those cases defining ownership, or were they defining what's an insurable interest?
They were dealing with ownership, if my memory is correct.
Doesn't Safeco say that if there's a term like ownership that has a broad possible meanings, that you take the meaning most favorable to the insured?
I believe, if I remember reading those cases correctly, you take what is determined to be the everyday meaning.
If it's ambiguous, though, you always take the meaning favorable.
If it's ambiguous, you have to find in favor of the insured. I understand it.
As Judge Blackmore once said from this bench, he said, I never read an insurance policy unless my client paid me to. I mean, if you expect professors like Charlie Blackmore to understand all these policies, it's a daunting task. And so, I mean, it's the duty of the law is developed as far as ambiguities. It's your responsibility to make it as clear as possible, like the Flesch test, which was current 20, 30 years ago. But the Flesch test to make sure, and the Sullivan Law in New York, make sure people understand by your definitions and clearly, so people don't have to read the Leitner case and then the Swanger case. Oh, that's a good case. To read the Leitner case, the Swanger and others, to understand what your policy says.
The only thing that I can offer in response to that, because I understand the issue. I get that. And that's why I said at the forefront, ownership is touchstone to this. But what the court has to keep in mind is Nathaniel knew this too, because Nathaniel had purchased two policies, each for his other Fords, with UIM coverage. Mm-hmm. And when he took possession of this motorcycle from his uncle after paying some money, he went out and went to American Standard 21 days before this accident, and he purchased a policy, including UIM coverage. As he needed to do, because he understood that he had the right to possess and control, and that he needed to get UIM coverage to protect him while driving this particular vehicle.
But finishing my question I was asking before, although all these are partial answers to it, so I appreciate it. If I understand you correctly, if what you're saying, what the Court of Appeals said, I should say, is that insurable interest equals ownership, wouldn't the uncle have had an insurable interest still because title was still in his name? You're saying Nathaniel had one because he had ownership. If, say, Nathaniel's parents had lent him money to buy it, so he owed him money, they had an insurable interest in it. We would have a lot of owners, none of which we would have, because they all would have insurable interest. None of them could get coverage. It seems like having... Is that a reasonable definition of owner if everybody with an insurable interest is an owner and so none of them have coverage? And then the second is in the definition from those earlier cases where you're saying possession and control. Didn't they also say ability to dispose of? And so that's an issue. Since he hadn't finished paying for it, could he dispose
that's,
of it?
That's another issue that comes into play. Absolutely.
And I know that's two parts, so go ahead.
But if this court makes the decision that the title is controlling, there's nothing I can do about it because the facts are what the facts are.
He didn't have title. And I see this problem with if I see this problem with insurable interest being controlling, because you could have lots of different people with insurable interest. So you're saying they're all owners?
There's no question that Nathaniel's uncle, from whom he was buying the motorcycle, I assume. Well, the uncle, if he had a policy on the Yamaha and the uncle was driving the Yamaha, then yes, that uncle would be covered under his policy, whoever that might be from.
And they'd both be owners.
They could both be owners, yes.
And do you think that's the reasonable understanding of what the word owner means?
Absolutely, and that's what Nathaniel understood, and that's why he bought the policy from American Family 21 days before this accident. He realized it was, quote, his motorcycle and that he needed to go out and get liability coverage, get UM coverage, get UIM coverage, and he did it because he realized that this was his motorcycle and he wanted to protect himself under the UIM coverage just as he did on his other two Fords.
Does the American Family use the same policy for owner and operator?
Does American Family use the same? Yes.
Okay,
yes.
So how did he know he went by?
That's one of my cases before. American Family's policy is an owner's and an operator's policy.
I might have remembered that. So how do you know when he went out and bought it that he wasn't just buying an operator's policy?
Well, he bought both.
Right.
Well,
but you don't need to be an owner.
It's the same policy.
Correct, Judge. You don't have to be an owner to buy an operator's policy.
But you sold them both and collected premiums on all these policies. I mean, it's a number of policies. Well, couldn't you make it clear to them that you're not going to get covered resolving you the insurance, but don't worry, we're not going to give you the money if something happens.
No, when the agent for American Family did sell him the Yamaha motorcycle policy, he is covered under the Yamaha. We're not denying that he's not covered under the motorcycle.
You're questioning if he's an owner or not, which is,
No, we're saying that he is an owner, hence the owned vehicle exclusion applies, because he is the owner. When he was sold the policy, Judge, American Standard is saying that's fine.
You
are the owner.
Snap.
You've taken possession. Yeah. You're buying it from your uncle. You are covered. We're not denying that.
But you're saying you can't stack it, is what you're saying.
Correct. Right.
My question is, how do you know he bought the owner's policy or the operator's policy if it's the same policy?
They're together. You get American Family
both,
Judge.
I understand you get both, but you're making the argument was, well, he knew he was the owner, so he bought this policy. And I'm like, well, maybe he knew he was the operator when he bought the policy.
But he also bought the UIM coverage as well that goes along with it. I don't know his state of mind, Judge.
I guess that's my point. I mean, none of us get to crawl in anybody's head, so we're stuck with what these policies say.
Correct.
And I understand your argument, and it starts making sense to me, but then it's the same policy. He could have purchased it as an operator. He didn't have to be the owner. If he was not an owner and he purchased that same policy, it would be the same policy.
It would still be the same argument, Judge, because I'm assuming that it would have the UIM coverage, even in your question that you're proposing.
Right,
even if it's an operator's policy,
right.
It would still have the UIM coverage that we have here, and it would still have the owned vehicle exclusion, even if it's an operator's policy. So we're still going to have the same question before the court, even if it's an operator's policy.
Well, I understand it's the same question, but the fact that he purchased the policy doesn't lead any credence to the fact that he's an owner.
Oh,
it's the
I
same
think,
policy.
In my opinion, yes, it does, Judge, because of what's taught to us under Leitner, Safeco, and Paul, that title isn't necessarily determinative when you're dealing with insurance questions. It's again, possession, ability, control, use it, treat it as your own. All of these are factors that go into when these courts determine whether or not there's coverage. So I think that's a big difference.
Counsel, you seem to suggest that UIM coverage is really a vehicle coverage. Opposing counsel, if I understood her, said it's really coverage on the person.
It is.
And you carry it with you, and if you're in different vehicles and so forth, it's personal to you.
It is personal from the standpoint that the UIM coverage, and I have 30
Please
seconds, so I'm
going
to address your question. It is personal to the extent that I have UIM coverage on my vehicle that's parked outside, and that protects me while I'm driving that vehicle. It also protects me up while I'm riding in your car, and it also protects me when I'm driving somebody else's car. What it doesn't protect me from is the exclusion that we're here to talk about this morning. It does not protect me in my wife's car that's back home in St. Louis when I'm driving that car unless I have purchased UIM coverage on that car that's available to me. That's the difference that I believe is being ignored by appellants in this
particular
case.
We'll give you a little more time because we gave Ms. Garrison a little more time. In every other context, though, title, when it deals with motor vehicles, that's why you have the title. If GM has a loan, for example, you're paying off the loan to GM or GMAC, the title says it's in this person's name and GMAC is the takes over if you don't pay the payments. But the title in motor vehicles, that's why they have it that way, it's supposed to, because so many transfers, it's supposed to be almost prima facie. If you have title, you own it.
But
if you don't have title, you don't.
But there's also a line of cases, Judge, with all due respect, that say even if you don't have title to a motor vehicle, you can have some type of other insurable interest in that vehicle outside of title. I just lost a case before the Court of Appeals on that very issue.
And there's one that said someone whose father had put his name on the title still wasn't an owner because it was just put on there. And
that's the Leitner case.
So it's certainly confusing.
That's the Leitner case.
Thank
you
very
much.
It's a complicated case, as you argued as well.
Your Honors, if I could address that last point first. I think that what opposing counsel is saying in terms of the Leitner case is almost exactly backward what Leitner does say. In that case, the son's name was on the title, and this court held in that case, well, you're not the owner, because of the facts and circumstances. And in that case, the son had possession of the truck, and he had full use of the truck with little or no control by the father. And the court said, no, that's not enough. You're not the owner, even when your name is on the title. So I think that Leitner fully supports our position, both on the ambiguity and the factual end. I think it's also very, very clear. You can't say Nathaniel bought the, he admits he's an owner because he bought the policy. You don't have to be an owner to have the policy, liability or UIM. So I don't think that that really means anything. And if you look at the police report, you know, that's Defendant's Exhibit E. If you look at what he said at the time of the accident, they said, you know, the police said, well, who owns this Yamaha? Well, my uncle owns it. So, you know, if we're talking about state of mind, then that's what he believed. The other thing I want to point out is on the stacking issue and the second sentence of the other insurance provision, James' policy doesn't have anything to do with whether Nathaniel owned. You have to look at James' policy as you're James reading that policy. That second sentence says that if there's insurance provided under this endorsement for an insured person while occupying a vehicle you don't own. Well, James didn't own the Yamaha. So, you know, Nathaniel is an insured person under James' policy. So regardless of Nathaniel, James didn't own the Yamaha, so that second sentence applies. We get stacking, and there's no set-off.
I just wanted to ask you real quickly about Safeco. Does that really help you? In Safeco, they talk about the definition and the meaning of the word owner, and they try to imply that if you have dominion over the property or control, regardless of whether the title is held in another person's name, you still could be, according to the broadest interpretation of owner, an owner.
Your Honor, I think that, you know, what's happening in those cases is the same tenet upon which we're relying. In those cases, the court was construing owner loosely in order to provide coverage. So in our case, you apply or you say owner means what it usually means, which is title. That's what's supportive of coverage. So the same tenant, if you apply it consistently, in this case says that ownership does mean what it usually means, and that's title.
That standard is ambiguous, whether it means one definition or another definition or three definitions. Our standard is ambiguous, and if it's ambiguous, then we would cover the insurer.
That's correct.
Well, but, I mean, the reason behind that rule or policy of interpretation is because your client didn't draft the policy or the contract, right?
That's correct.
If American Family wants to be sure about what own means, if they want own to mean insurable interest, they can have an insurable interest exclusion.
They sure could. That's correct, Your Honor. I mean, there's a couple of reasons behind the ambiguity rule, one of them being what you just said. The other is, you know, I guess you buy these policies, you go out and you pay the premiums, you expect you're going to be covered. Why else would you buy them? That's why we all buy insurance policies.
Why would they sell it to you if it's a double?
Well, to be fair, opposing counsel says that there's coverage. It's just a question of stacking.
Right.
That there's certainly primary coverage provided.
Well, Your Honor, that's true. But in this case, of course, he bought three policies, and his dad bought another one. So without really talking about reasonable expectations, I think that still, just looking straight at the law, looking straight up at what you do if you find an ambiguity, you have to construe in favor of the insured, because it is the insurance companies that are after, and they have the obligation to make it clear.
Was Leitner a UIM coverage case?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Leitner was an uninsured motorist case.
I believe it was. I believe it was.
Thank you very much.
So thank you so much.
Well argued on both sides. I love the exhibit. It was great.
Oh.
Thank you for trying to simplify the issue.